is tape number 5, the morning of January the 5th, 1961. You were talking about the Dred Scott decision and so forth.
Well, the Dred Scott decision and the role it had in connection with precipitating the war between the states.
It was too bad that that decision had to be made in the manner in which it was. Of course, we can see now how things could have been somewhat different if that Dred Scott decision had not been in conformity with the Fugitive Slave Act, which had been passed by the Congress and signed by the President. So the only way you can come to a conclusion on that is to read the decision and read the arguments which are made on both sides of the case. But it was made what they call now in these days a cause celebre, which means a celebrated cause in that period, and was one of the causes of the demagogues, that the demagogues used to bring about the war between the states. It's too bad that it had happened.
Now, in those days, the Congress, both houses, were pretty much under the control of the South, were they not?
Yes. Yes, they were.
And that more or less created an imbalanced situation in the conduct of the
affair. But you must remember that that control was also made up of the Democrats in Pennsylvania. That's where James Buchanan came from. He was a Democrat. Franklin Pierce came from New Hampshire. He was a Democrat. And it wasn't entirely the South. There were, I'd say, a majority of the congressmen and senators from the northern part of the United States were Democrats, as they were from the South, naturally. And it was not altogether the South that brought these things about. It was legislation that was passed by a Congress that was under the control of the chief executive, and he didn't control them. That's all it was to it.
Well, take, for instance, the man Calhoun. Was he controllable? He was pretty much doing the controlling, wasn't he?
He was vice president of Andrew Jackson, and he believed in nullification. And he finally resigned. And Jackson, if you remember, said that the two things he left undone was to shoot Henry Clay and hang John C. Calhoun. He thought John C. Calhoun was superior to the government.
Incidentally, why do you think he made the distinction between shooting and hanging him in case of both individuals?
Henry Clay made some snide remarks about Andrew Jackson's wife. And he thought he should have challenged him to a duel to challenge. He thought he ought to hang John C. Calhoun as a traitor. That was the difference.
Now, the Supreme Court has always been a kind of a dangling sword of Damascus over both the Congress and the President. And
you say Damascus or Damocles?
Damocles. I'm sorry.
A sword of the thread, that's what you mean.
And didn't the court, in a sense, do a great deal of intruding needlessly upon the functions of both of those branches?
There isn't a question about that. And that was brought about by two or three of the decisions of John Marshall, the first great Chief Justice. And those things have always been really helpful in the long run, because the Congress itself has a right to pass on the constitutionality of laws which they pass. And you'll find that where the High Court decides that certain laws of the Congress are unconstitutional, they can be written so that the next time it comes before the court, they'd agree to it. Take the Agricultural Adjustment Act. They decided that was unconstitutional. But when it was rewritten, there wasn't anything substantially different in the rewritten part of the thing, except a few A's, ands, and these, and some theories and commas, which set the thing up in the manner in which it was intended to be in the first place. It's the business of the court to define what a law really means and to protect the rights of the people who are in the courts for the settlement of grievances. And when they go outside that viewpoint, the Congress can always find a way to get around them, and they always have.
Well, But in a sense, if you were to differentiate the three branches, there were sometimes runaway Congresses.
That's correct.
And there were do-nothing presidents.
That's right.
But there were always, there's never been a runaway court. There's always been folding back. The courts have always been a little bit behind the times, maybe?
That's all right. They're what in modern days they call conservative. That is, they don't believe in going forward too fast. But that's the reason the government was set up in the manner in which it is. It's called a check and balance government. And each one of the sections of the executive, the legislative, and the judicial are really a check on the other two. And that's what makes the government safe for the people. No man on horseback can take it over and run away with it.
Well, is that how you visualize the Supreme Court's major function?
Yes, yes. It's as a check on a runaway Congress or a president who doesn't do anything. And it's worked all right up to date. Never been any reason why we should battle against the Supreme Court only about legislation.
What about a president who does too much?
We've never had one that I know of.
Well, you've had three periods in which, Jefferson certainly went outside the Constitution on his Louisiana Purchase. You had Lincoln, who threw away much of the restraint of the Supreme Court. And yet FDR, who was considerably embarrassed by the Supreme Court during his program and had to do something about reconstructing it.
And you also had, Mr. President, your own case in the question of the steel.
Yes, we had six different verdicts, six different decisions.
Eight opinions by seven members of the court, if I'm not correct. There are seven decisions, seven reports by six judges, I forget which it was. Anyway, they never did come to conclusion.
Frankfurter gave
you're talking about the Steele decision.
Yes, that's right. But you were asking me about the runaway presidents, and referred particularly to Jefferson's purchase of Louisiana. I think that Jefferson's purchase of Louisiana was one of the great things of one of the great presidents, one of the great decisions of one of the great presidents, because had he not have taken over Louisiana, either Britain, France, or Spain would have owned it, and we'd have been ended at the Mississippi River. And the greatest part of our development has been by the ability to expand toward the Pacific coast. And then you talk about Jackson's difficulties with the court. He was enforcing the law when he had his troubles with the court, that is, the Tariff Act, which South Carolina decided they wouldn't pay. They nullified it. And the old man didn't stand for nullification. He collected the tax, and they paid it. And, of course, Lincoln, in his period, suspended habeas corpus and several other things, which he had to do in order to save the Union at the time, but those were all restored as soon as the emergency was over.
Well, actually, he dismissed the Circuit Court of Appeals, a whole bunch of them, and appointed new judges in the District of Columbia.
Yes, and he expanded the Supreme Court to 11 members from 7, if you remember.
That's right.
Well, it was necessary at the time.
Well, why, sir? Did you develop that a little?
He was doing it to save the Union. That's all he was doing.
Well, were these people trying to...
These people were trying to hamper the president so he couldn't do his job, and he decided that they couldn't do it. And Franklin Roosevelt had his difficulties with the nine old men, if you remember. But in his effort to change the situation, he went at it in a manner that was caused the difficulty, which he finally ran into. But the court was finally changed because the nine old men got out of the way. They had to. The end of the term came.
Well, but in that sense, Lincoln did become a dictator.
Oh, yes, he had to be. He was called a dictator and a tyrant. That's what Booth shot him for.
That's right, the tyrannus. But in that case, you were now saying that there are times when the assumption of dictatorial powers by a president beyond the scope of the Constitution is allowable.
I don't think he ever went beyond the scope of the Constitution.
Correct.
I think he met the situation in the emergency which the Constitution provides for, and it was necessary that he meet it. Suppose he hadn't. Suppose one of those great northern generals, like Grant or old Sherman, had been willing to say, this ought to be done, we'll take it over and march in there with his people. Lincoln maintained his position as civilian commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and I don't think he ever went outside the things, only doing those things that are necessary to save the Union. I think that's what he was doing.
Therefore, to save the Constitution.
That's right. And the Constitution was restored in its entirety after it was over.
He brushed aside during the emergency all those constitutional provisions which were hampering him.
In the job that was necessary at the time to be done. That's all there was to it. And Franklin Roosevelt did the same thing. He had to. And it's in the World War II, when we had the same sort of a difficulty, he went ahead and accomplished the purpose. That was to save the free world. I had some of the same
difficulty. Well, he accepted the verdict of the Supreme Court, and you did too. Now, Why did you accept the verdict of the Supreme Court on the Steele
decision? Because I wanted people to understand that the respect for the court is one of the first things that the population has to have. I didn't have to accept it. I didn't have to pay attention to it. But it was the proper thing to do, for the simple reason that maintained the respect that people ought to have for the judicial branch of the government.
But we were in an emergency, too.
I agree. We were in an emergency, and the emergency showed up a little later.
Well, President,
under the fellow they were trying to protect.
That's right. Well, Mr. President, what would have happened if you had disregarded the Supreme Court?
I'd just gone over and taken over the steel works and put them to work like I intended to do in the first place. And which I had the perfect right to do, but I didn't do it. But I thought I wanted to establish the necessity for people to understand that the judicial branch of the government should be respected. And sometimes they make bad decisions, but you can always have them repealed by legislation in some other way.
In other words, you felt that it was much more important to maintain the checks and balances at that time than to exercise the full powers of the presidency, which you felt you had at that time.
That's correct. Although the emergency that was during the Korean situation, the emergency was not as great as it would have been 5 years earlier, or even in Lincoln's time. The emergency would have been great enough to go ahead and do what was necessary.
In other words, Mr. President, if the emergency had really been intensified, then you would have disregarded.
We'd have gone ahead and done whatever's necessary to meet it.
In other words,
and we'd have been in constitutionally right in doing it.
You could have re-invoked the Second War Powers Act under the end of the war and gone ahead and done it.
That's right.
So these institutions in balance have much more latitude during peacetime than they do have during emergency times. And you are saying, in effect, that comes an emergency, the principal source of power to govern resides in the person of the president.
Is there any question about it? You either have to have that or you have to go to the old Roman idea of setting up a dictator. We never had to do that. The Romans, whenever they got into trouble in their republic, they always elected a dictator. He carried through what was necessary. You don't have to do that under the Constitution of the United States. The president exercises his emergency powers, which are usually always granted by the Congress when the time comes for him to come about, and you don't have to have a dictator. He has the power to go ahead and do what's necessary, because in emergencies, decisions have to be made here and now. They can't wait.
Well, Mr. President, may I ask you this question now in connection with the Eisenhower administration? On several occasions in the foreign field, he wanted a show from Congress or some vote by them before he would make a decision. What did you think of such a
decision? He should have made the decision and ask the Congress to endorse it, which they'll always do.
What you're saying then, to interpret you some more, or to clarify it for us, is that when we are in an emergency, you have to suspend the normal procedures in order to expedite decisions.
That's right. When the welfare of the country is completely at stake, and that's the thing that's fundamentally basic, and you'll find the Congress always in agreement in a case of that kind.
This is the end of take number 5, the morning of January 5th, 1961. Take number 6, the morning of January 5th, 1961. Mr. President, you were saying that
the emergency powers that are in the president and are authorized to be in the president by the Congress when the emergency comes along is the principal reason why this republic of ours has continued through emergencies. In times past, the great republics have been overturned, because in the time of the Roman Republic, they always elected a dictator. The time came when the dictator became the emperor of the Roman Empire instead of the Roman Republic. And that's happened, and the overturn of all the great republics is because they had no way to meet an emergency when the emergency came along. In our case, the emergencies have been met due to the fact that emergency powers are usually voted to the president by the Congress when the time is necessary for that to be done, and the president exercises them as the leader of a republic and not as a dictator.
And in spanning over our past history and scanning your mind over the period, would you say that the country has never suffered from the act of a president as much as it suffered from the inaction of a president?
That's absolutely true. It's never suffered seriously from any acts of the president, which are always in for the welfare and benefit of the country. It has suffered by the inaction of a great many presidents when action should have been taken at the right time.
At the same time, Mr. President, what you're saying is very important for us to understand clearly, and I think it's a very important point that you're making, that where governments haven't got the immediate normal authority to meet a situation, they have to resort to dictatorship and sometimes the overthrow of the government.
That's exactly correct. That's what happened to the French after the Revolution of 1789. Napoleon took charge because there was nobody to do anything. They were standing still, and somebody had to take over and make the thing work. Same thing happened in the Roman Empire when Augustus Caesar took over, and the Dutch Republic had the same result. They fell down because they did not have the means to meet an emergency. You take in the limited monarchies, they always have the head of a state. If he has the ability to take charge, and in most instances, in the case of England, which is the greatest limited monarchy in the history of the world, they've taken over the emergency and met the emergency when it came about. Those presidents of the United States who met the emergencies were always endorsed and approved, not only by the people in the Congress, but by the whole world when they acted.
No, what you, and therefore what you're saying is that where you deprecate these weak presidents who failed to make decisions with regard to all those events which led to the Civil War, that there is where you did actually have a breakdown of government because they had failed to make the proper
decisions. They failed to meet the situation as it came up in most instances. Oh. And, of course, I don't think any of them thought they were doing that because they had not had the history and background that the gentleman had who wrote the Constitution of the United States.
Well, the fullest exercise of freedom then under the Constitution is a luxury which can be enjoyed in normal times, but you're saying now that in times of emergency, some of these freedoms or liberties have to be surrendered, and they can only be surrendered to the person of the president who has to exercise
them. Well, they're not surrendered. They're authorized under the Constitution as it is written, and the reason for the necessity of the exercise of that power is to save the very freedoms under which we live all the time. That's the only reason for it. And we save those freedoms under every emergency to which we live.
Would you accept the word suspended instead of surrender?
I think suspended is a better word.
That's better.
Because the Constitution is still in effect. I think it ought to be suspended. So, yeah.
Now, Lincoln had a turnabout in his own position on the question of abolition. At one time, he said that a majority in any community had a right to express its preference and could secede from any government. He actually approved at one time of secession, didn't he, in his earlier period?
Well, I don't know whether he ever approved of it or not, but he made that statement to the elected.
I see. Very, very good distinction. When he actually issued the Emancipation Proclamation, that in itself was stretching the Constitution beyond its original intent, wasn't it?
Well, yes. That is to meet an emergency and save the Union. And I think that's the reason he did it. And he lived, I think, the Reconstruction Program and the rehabilitation and the proper education and the care for the former slaves would have been much better handled than it was after that.
At another time, we'd like for you to develop this business of the Reconstruction Program and what we did that was so wrong, because you more or less carried out a Reconstruction Program among the enemies after
That's
the
right.
war.
And that Reconstruction Program worked.
And we might be, it might be a good idea to develop those two if you could.
That's right.
Hi, Mr. President. This is the end of tape number 6, the morning of January 6, 1961. January
5th, 1961. That's right. In the Green Morning, it was.
I don't think there's ever been so much money put in one place.
No, on the contrary.
That's worth the price of a book right now.